Thanks, Ben. I'm glad you read that, because even though I've been practicing, I find it very difficult to say Bartholomew. Unless I say it very slowly. I'm pleased that my friend goes by Bart. Makes it a lot easier. But I've got a friend who's 97 years old. He was the pastor of one of the churches that sent out Grace Church Greenwich 7 years ago. He's called Dick Lucas. Some of you may know of him. He is a very famous preacher and built a whole ministry at St. Helens Bishopsgate. And then some of us come from there, or Grace Church Greenwich was partly planted from there. And occasionally I have the privilege of going for lunch with Dick Lucas at 97. And I started doing it a few years ago before the pandemic. And I said to him, "Dick, I really appreciate your feedback on my preaching." And he said, "Well, you know, give me a while to just think about it and I'll get back to you." And so yeah, he would be in the congregation for a few weeks. And then I had lunch with him again. And he said, I said, "Dick, did you have any feedback?" He said, "Well, there's just a couple of things." And he said, "You know, when you go to the fish and chip shop and you order fish and chips, and indeed people in your congregation, when they go to the fish and chip shop, they order fish and chips. But when you're in the pulpit, Andrew, you need to order fish and chips." And what he was saying was, "Andrew, you mumble." And it's a very lovely way of saying it. "Don't gabble. We need to hear every syllable. So try and speak in a way that's intelligible." When I get too excited, I'll probably do it today. I stumble over words like Bartholomew, and you can't hear all the syllables. Another bit of feedback that he famously gave, and it wasn't actually to me, but to another preacher, and they said, "Dick, what did you think of the sermon on Sunday?" And he said, "Too many vegetables on the plate, brother." And what he meant was, I think he was, you know, of the old-fashioned British Sunday lunch, which is meat and two veg. We don't want five veg. Now, you may have a different dietary practice, but what he meant was that it's just crowded with too many things. It's like one of those, you know, the over-ambitious MasterChef final, where they try to do like 10 different little things on the plate. And he thought it'd be much better with just some sort of focus to it. And I thought, he didn't say this of me last week, but I thought this was true of last week's sermon, "Too many vegetables on the plate." Thank you for coming back after last week's sermon. I thought it was the kind of sermon with hindsight that might well give you indigestion. There were so many things because we took so many verses all at once and we're all a bit overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed and I'd been preparing it for the whole week. So I don't know how you did, just hearing it all in one mouthful. So with that in mind, we thought we'd go to the opposite extreme today. So rather than doing four paragraphs with loads and loads of theology, we've just got one paragraph where Jesus goes up a mountain and then chooses 12 people. And there's nothing really in the passage apart from Jesus going up and praying and then appointing Simon, who he called Peter, Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, Simon, Judas, and the other Judas. So this is a sermon about those 12 people, and that's all I'm going to talk about for this whole half hour or 20 minutes, whatever it is. What is so interesting about these names? Could you even name them? If I were to ask you, it's a sort of Christian pub quiz question, can you name all 12 apostles? I probably could, but not easily. I'd be scratching. Someone I've missed out. Who is it I've missed out? And it might well be the other Judas, because there's the famous traitor one and the other one. Could you name them? And who cares if you could name them? Like, why does it matter to be able to name the 12 apostles, apart from for trivia? Actually, somebody last night was talking about a pub quiz where they'd had, I think it was you, Andy, on their team, and there's a Bible round. And I was just saying to them, you know that pastors hate Bible rounds in pub quizzes because you just feel so exposed. Like, there's an expectation that I will know all of these very, very obscure questions. But who are the 12 apostles? Well, Luke obviously thinks it matters because in his gospel, he records them for us. Simon, Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, Simon, Judas, and Judas. Why do we care? Well, the first point on the handout, you'll see I've got a little outline on the inside of here if you want to follow along. The first point is that these are actual names of actual people because Luke is recording actual history. And in fact, Luke is pretty obsessed with actual names of actual people. He goes into a lot of names. I mean, chapter 3 always is a good example for me. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of the region of Iturea and Trachonitis, Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, during the high priest of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of the God came to John, the son of Zechariah, in the wilderness. That's a lot of names, isn't it? But it's not how you start a myth. You know, once upon a time, there was an old woman who lived in a cottage in the wood. As soon as you read it, you think this is history. This is about specific events and specific people. And named people. Now, why does named people help? Well, it tells us that it happened, but it tells those 2,000 years ago who were first reading this manuscript that they could check. Now, if you doubt this, if you want to check this out, these are the people that you can ask. These are the people who were there. And the reliability of the message, I guess, depends on the reliability of the people who are putting their name to it. Now, I don't know about you, but that is instinctively how I check something out, even nowadays. Now, I want to know whether I can trust something. I want to know who's behind it. So as you know, Andrew and I both work part-time for a Bible college called Cornhill. And last year, there was a new Bible college appeared in London. And it had a website and it looked very flashy. And the principal, Nigel, emailed around saying, does anyone know anything about this? And we were, you know, curious, you know, who is the competition? What are they up to? And it was a very slick website and it had all their, you know, these are our learning goals. These are our learning pathways. Here are some amazing pictures from the top of the Shard showing London. You know, it looked visually fantastic. But I thought, I didn't know, like, what do they stand for? Who are they? And what I wanted to do in order to work out whether I could trust it or not was find some names. Can I find out who's on the faculty and what do I know about them? Now, obviously, that can have a downside, can't it? Because it just becomes an in club where you only trust the people that know the people that you know. But it also kind of makes some sense because the people that know the people that you know are people whose honesty you can find out. With a phone call, or, you know, what's so-and-so up to in this new college? And so I wanted to know names. It's partly why on our Grace Church Greenwich website, we have a who's who page. And something I don't like about that is it's not everyone's faith, because who's who is, this is Grace Church Greenwich. You know, it's not just one or two people who happen to be employed by the church or happen to be ministry trainees. You know, we are Grace Church Greenwich. So ideally, we'd have all of our names on the Who's Who page. In fact, we did try that a couple of years ago because we didn't want it just to be staff names. And so we put loads of congregation members. We put Caroline because she was in charge of the music at the time. And we had Hang and Janice because they were running the international ministry at the time. And we ended up with having loads and loads of people. And one of my friends said, wow, the staff of Grace Church Greenwich is enormous, isn't it? Which wasn't really the point we were trying to make. But who's who? So you can kind of check, you know, what does Grace Church Greenwich stand for? We could put a lovely picture looking out of that window and we could have some motivational slogans. But one of the ways that people check, certainly that I check about churches, is to find out who are they. Well, let's imagine we're asking that question not just about a particular church, but about the church. Like the whole church, like at the beginning when the church was relatively unknown. And who are this group of people that call themselves Christians? Who are they? Well, they're the people associated with Simon and Peter. I keep saying that. Simon, he's called Peter, one person. Simon and Andrew and James and John and Philip and Bartholomew and Matthew and Thomas and James and Simon and Judas and the other Judas. It's not that these people were sensationally famous, actually. They were kind of nobodies at first. But they were historical people. They were people who had brothers. They were people who had fathers, Judas, the son of James. They're people from whom you could check. And as the gospel was first announced, to make it specific about where it happened and who it happened to, immediately stops you kind of freely making it up. You can't say anything you want about Jesus because here are the people that people are going to ask about it. And it turns out the people they ask about it have the same name. Some of you know this already, this argument, but it is quite cool if you've never heard it. This is a book that came out about a decade ago, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by Professor Richard Borkham. And it's a book that was quite revolutionary in New Testament skepticism in the academy. People used to be very dismissive, thinking, oh, the Bible's just sort of this collection of religious ideas that have evolved over time. And Richard Borkham wrote this book where he really called people to take seriously the claim that this is an eyewitness testimony about real people. And one of the things he does is he checks out all of the names in the whole of the gospel and works out what people are called, and then puts them in order of popularity of names. So we could do the same thing for Grace Church Greenwich. I reckon, it's a bit of a contest, isn't it, at the moment, but I reckon the most popular boy's name in Greenwich is, in Grace Church Greenwich, is Andrew. I think there are, I don't know how many, I didn't count them today, but I can see at least four. Andrew, there's Andrew Wasey, there's Andrew McCallum, there's Andrew Latimer, there's Andrew Satch. Any other Andrews here today? Yeah, oh yeah, Andrew at the back, Andrew next to Ava. Andrew Reader, if I can't remember your surname. Yes, yeah, Andrew and Jess. Yeah, okay, there we are. So we challenge you to beat us, right? Now, that, what does that tell you about Grace Church Greenwich that everyone's called out? I don't know, maybe that's why you come. I doubt that. It tells you something about naming trends at the time that we grew up in the country that we grew up. You know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, people tended to call their kids in the country we're from Andrew. But naming trends really do change around the world. So if we were a church in Singapore, we wouldn't all be called Andy, probably. If we were a church in Uganda, if we were a church in China, there'd be other names that were popular. Because, of course, you know, naming trends vary across the world. And naming trends vary across decades as well. So my dad is called Howard. Are there any Howards here? Like, no one gets called Howard anymore. I don't know. Well, it's a perfectly nice name. It's just not a currently popular name. Maybe there'll be some sort of swing and everyone will call their children Howard, but they don't at the moment. And so just by the sort of things that people are called, you can kind of work out where are you in the world and when did you write it. Now, Richard Borkham does this with the Gospels. It turns out the most popular name in the New Testament is, for a boy, is Simon. And there's the second most popular, there's eight different Simons. And did you notice, even in our reading, there's two different guys called Simon. There's Peter, Simon who he called Peter, and the Simon who was called the Zealot. And you just need nicknames, don't you? Because if everyone's called the same, it gets a bit confusing. Which Simon do you mean? So you call him Lats, and you call me Satchi. And you call him Peter, and you call him the Zealot. So there's lots and lots of Simons. Second most popular name, Joseph. Third most popular name, Lazarus. Fourth most popular name, Judas. And there's two Judases, even amongst the apostles, five Judases altogether. Judas, interestingly, dropped in popularity as a name quite sharply after this point, right? And then what he does is he compares them with what people were called in different decades and what people are called in different places. So some people, for example, thought, oh, the whole of the New Testament was made up and it was written in Egypt because there were Christians around Alexandria quite early on. So maybe it was all made up in Egypt. Yeah, except that in Egypt, everyone is called Eliezer. And there aren't any Eliezers in the New Testament. So it's just that people are called the things that people are called. And Luke gives us their names, and he gives us their dads, and he gives us their brothers. Because this is real history. Not long, long ago, far, far away, vaguely. But these particular people in these particular places, it really happened, says Luke. And Luke really cares about the fact that it really happened. Because he tells us right at the very beginning of the gospel, in the first few verses, that he's investigating everything from the eyewitnesses so that his friend Theophilus can be certain about the things he's been taught. And Theophilus is already a Christian. And his friend Luke has written him this gospel and says, you know the things you believe as a Christian? I want you to be really sure about them. And the reason he wants him to be really sure is because he wants him to tell other people. And I guess that's true of us as well. Like, many of us here will be Christians. I guess not everyone, and you're very welcome if you're not a Christian, if you're just looking into these things. But many of us will be Christians. But to be sure enough about it to tell other people, you kind of got to be extra sure. To be sure about it to survive the cross-examination or the teasing or the, all of those fairy stories, says one of your friends in Trinity Laban. Oh, you don't even believe all that, do you? Says your friend at the school gate. And to be sure enough to sort of face that opposition, you need grounds to be certain. It's not just I take a leap of faith. It's I put my trust in real history about real people. And so Luke cares about who they are, and he tells us who they are, 12 apostles. That's the first reason, historical names. Secondly, revolutionary names. By which I mean that by choosing 12 leaders at this point, Jesus is really mounting a revolution. Because actually there were in his society already religious leaders. There was the high priest, Caiaphas. There was the Sanhedrin, which was the Jewish council with people like Nicodemus on it. And Jesus just ignores Caiaphas and Nicodemus and says, I'll have you. Simon and the other Simon and I'll have Thaddeus and I'll have, I can't remember their names, James and John. And Jesus chooses leaders. And the one thing that Luke does for us, apart from give us their names, is count them for us. Now you think I can count myself, but he tells us verse 13, when day came, Jesus called his disciples and chose for them 12. And then he gives them the names. Now, why do we care so much about the number? Well, you can't go wrong with numbers in the Bible. Sometimes people look a little bit too hard for significance in every single number. And, you know, there's all sorts of crazy theories about why there are 153 fish in John's Gospel, why the number of the beast is 666. Actually, I think both those numbers do have a significance. But you can kind of keep going and you just find significance in absolutely every number everywhere. But the number 12 is a particularly famous number in the Bible. What is so famous about the number 12? Well, for any Jewish person, it's a very obvious question. Why 12? Well, because there's 12 tribes. God rescued the 12 tribes of Israel at the Exodus, the 12 sons of Jacob. And there's lots of places in the Old Testament where they're named. You get a list of 12 names, like this list of 12 names. And interestingly, in Exodus chapter 24, they all go up a mountain to meet with God. And here's Jesus going up a mountain and choosing 12. And it gets explicit actually later in Luke's gospel that Jesus is choosing leaders for the 12 tribes of Israel. When he chooses 12 apostles, they are going to be the leaders. Just look at chapter 22. I've got the cross-reference on the handout. But Luke 22, verse 30. I found this, by the way, if you're wondering what my method is in Bible study, I just searched 12. And I thought I'd just find all the places where Luke mentions there being 12 people. And I found this one, Luke 22, verse 30, which I thought was very helpful. Jesus talking to his apostles. And he says, you are those who stayed with me in my trials. I assigned to you as my father assigned to me a kingdom that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. The 12 apostles, or maybe even the bigger number that are disciples of Jesus, become the leaders of the 12 tribes. The Christians become the head of the Jews. Now, that isn't as revolutionary as it sounds to our ears, because the Christians at this point are Jews. So it's not a sort of anti-Semitic point. But it's saying that these Jews become head over all of the other Jews. These become the leaders of the people of God. The people that Jesus chooses on a mountain. Now, the point is there's already leaders of Israel. There's already Pharisees. There's already a council. It'd be like Jesus turning up today and say, I announce that the new Archbishop of Canterbury is Ben. And everyone's like, really? I mean, like, I didn't even realize he was in the church. I'd like to say that the new head of the Methodist Church is Andrew McCallum. And suddenly you announce a new leadership of Christendom in a moment. And it's pretty revolutionary. Now, why does this happen here in the gospel? Why is this the moment that Jesus ups the ante and starts off his revolution? Well, the clue, I think, is what we saw last week. And if you weren't here last week, let me give you a short version of the too many vegetables on a plate sermon. Basically, people start loving Jesus, and at the end of it, they hate Jesus. They begin praising God for him, and at the end, they want to kill him. What is it that Jesus does that is so controversial? He announces that his religion is not going to be about trying to look very impressive on the outside, but it's going to be about receiving forgiveness because you're a wretch. Jesus associates with the people that no one expects him to associate with, the traitors to the nation, and the notorious sinners, the prostitutes, those who are swindling others to make their profit. You know, the lowlifes, and Jesus welcomes them, and people are scandalized that he welcomes them. And Jesus says, no, it's not the healthy that need a doctor, but the sick. I haven't come to call the morally righteous, but sinners to repentance. Jesus announced that his mission was all about forgiveness and change. And the religious establishment hated that because they considered that they didn't need to change. They didn't welcome a message of repentance, a message of forgiveness. We don't need that, thank you very much. Look at how very morally superior and religious we are. And they rejected him. And so Jesus straight away says, well, I would like to announce a new leadership. You know, it's a bit like what happened in the British government when people started opposing the Prime Minister. And I won't say which Prime Minister, because it's really true of all of the recent Prime Ministers. But when people start to turn against them, they just announce a cabinet reshuffle, and someone resigns in the cabinet, and then they fill the place in the cabinet, and then somebody else resigns, and then they appoint somebody else. And, you know, some people are only in the cabinet for a week or less. I mean, it just becomes kind of embarrassing. Yeah, it's like that, except Jesus isn't sort of desperate and insecure. He's not sort of hoping to shore up his government as people leave. Jesus does it in a very prayerful, quiet, confident way. I would like to pick you, and you to be the leadership of the church, to be the new judges of the nation of Israel. It's not a desperate response to rejection, but rather a very calm and supremely self-confident moving on, as if their rejection is an irrelevance. Like, you don't want to follow me? Okay, I'm not going to lose any sleep about that, because he's now one of the leaders. Oh, the great high priest is against me? Well, never mind, because I now announce him, that fisherman, can be in his place. See, it's shocking, isn't it? Because Jesus isn't kind of waiting desperately for the approval of Israel's leaders. When they reject him, he just moves on. He just replaces them. He just sparks a revolution. And this actually tells us how it works in the rest of the gospel, and in fact in the rest of the world. If you don't vote for Jesus, he doesn't lose sleep over it. Well, that's an unfortunate way to put it, because actually Jesus is very sad for our sake when we reject him. So maybe he does lose sleep. He's grieved by it. But when we reject Jesus, it doesn't sort of harm his claim to the throne. He just moves on. We just find ourselves outside. It's true of the early church. Not everyone agreed with all the apostles in the early church. But if you departed from the apostles, if you went out from them, well, you can do your own thing, but that's not where Jesus' church is. This is the foundation that he's chosen. If you're not with him, then you're against him. Historical names, real people, revolutionary names. Jesus chooses his own cabinet in his reshuffle. and then foundational names. So these names, these people, these 12 people become the authorized representatives. And I think this is such a good illustration. I'll get it back. Thank you, Carolina, for this. But this is the structure of the church. Actually, it's got put in the wrong order again. People are very keen for God's house to go down there, weren't they? But let's do it like that. The cornerstone, the foundation in God's house. The cornerstone is Jesus. The foundation is the apostles and prophets. And then this is us on top. And Carolina and I had a bit of debate about whether it ought to be like that, because surely the cornerstone is on the corner and part of the foundation. And we thought, well, that's true, like of that illustration. But actually, of course, the way it works is Jesus is the one that then teaches the apostles, who then teach the church. And we kind of thought, in the context, it's more like that, even though the corner should be on the corner. That's why a lot of thought went into this construction. But notice it's not this. Maybe that's what we would like. You know, we're Christians, so we want to build on Jesus. But it's quite hard to build on Jesus, because we haven't got a book written by Jesus. We don't have a sound recording of sermons preached by Jesus. And what we've actually got is the words of Jesus as recorded by the apostles. So Jesus is written up by the writers of the New Testament, and then we put our trust in this book. Not because we love Bibles for their own sake, but because we love Jesus. But this is the way that we get access to the words of Jesus. It's the words of Jesus through his apostles. And that becomes clear actually in Luke's own book too. So Luke wrote two books in the Bible. The first is the book of Luke's Gospel, and the second is the Acts of the Apostles. And the Acts of the Apostles follows straight on from Luke's Gospel as the sequel. And he even starts the Acts of the Apostles by saying, in the first book, Theophilus, it's like saying previously in The Lord of the Rings, or you know, whatever Netflix series you watch. In my first book, I dealt with what Jesus began to do and teach until the day he was taken up. Until the day when he was taken up to heaven, after he had given commands through the Holy Spirit to the apostles that he had chosen. So Jesus dies and rises again and ascends to heaven, but not before he's passed on his teaching, his commands, to these 12. This is essential to Jesus' plan. I'll do the dying for sins, says Jesus. I'll do the destroying death and being raised again, says Jesus. But I'm not going to do all the teaching. I'm going to give the teaching to you guys. So listen very carefully. I want to explain it to you, because you're going to be the ones who pass it on. And then everybody else needs to know that these are the guys who passed it on. Like, what about if other people later on try to claim different Christian messages? They want to say, I think Jesus would actually stand for my particular cause. Actually, people do this all the time. So in all the debates about anything, about the environmental agenda, about the future of marriage in the Church of England, lots of people have different views, and they all claim this is what Jesus would have said. How do you know what Jesus would have said? Well, the way that Jesus tells us that we can know what Jesus would have said is through his apostles, because these are the people who are appointed by Jesus to record his commandments, to pass on his teaching. And so there can't ever be any Christianity, really, apart from evangelical Christianity. Evangelical just means Christians who care about the gospel and about the word of God, about the Bible. Now, this is a very controversial statement, because people say, well, of course you would say that, wouldn't you, Andy, because you're a minister of an evangelical church. But it's not the only kind of church. You know, we've got liberal churches, we have Catholic churches, we have high churches. And why should you say that only evangelical churches are valid? I don't mean it's got to have the word evangelical in the title. In fact, we don't. We don't call ourselves Grace Church Evangelical Greenwich, Grace Church Evangelical Church Greenwich. But we are evangelical, by which I just mean, or we mean, that we make the foundation for everything we teach and say and do the Bible. That shouldn't just be one way of being a Christian. That's the only church built on this foundation. I mean, if you wanted to, you could build a church over here. You know, we base our church on what we sense Jesus would have liked, or what we feel Jesus would have liked. Or a church over here that you go, you know, we base our teaching on the tradition of what English people did in the 1200s. Okay, but it's not obviously a Christian church, is it? Because the Christian church is the one built on Jesus by the people that Jesus had appointed, and it's built on that foundation. Now, I don't mean that in a sort of congratulatory, well done us kind of way, but I do want to have grave suspicions about any church that calls itself Christian that wants to depart from what the apostles say. And so you've got to know who they are. Hang on, which are the people, again, who are authoritative, who are meant to be trusting? Oh, well, it's Peter. Now, he wrote lots of the New Testament. Peter wrote 1 Peter and 2 Peter. He was friend of Mark, who wrote Mark's Gospel. James and John. John, he wrote John's Gospel. He wrote John's letters. He wrote the book of Revelation. Now, these are the people whose names crop up again. Some of them, of course, don't. You think, well, what did Bartholomew write? Yeah, but Bartholomew was one of the eyewitnesses interviewed by Luke. He wrote Luke's Gospel and the Acts of the Apostles. These are the witnesses, the names who are the foundation, so that you can know what Jesus really says. Historical names, actual history about actual people, revolutionary names. Jesus ups the ante. And if people reject him, he just moves on and says, no, no, guys, it's happening over here. This is where the action is. Foundational names. This is the only foundation of the church. And then at the end, one chilling name. Just in there at number 12 in the list, just a little throwaway line that tells you that something is going to be desperately wrong. Judas Iscariot. We actually don't even need the line now, do we? Because even the name is so famous that even people who aren't Christians know what to be a Judas means. At the time that Luke first wrote it, maybe not everyone does realize. So he just puts in the spoiler, the plot spoiler. Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. How are we supposed to feel about that name in this list? Like Jesus is naive. He didn't realize. You know, he chose somebody to be in his cabinet about him. There would be a huge scandal. That's what happens in politics nowadays, isn't it? And you go, your judgment is seriously in question, Rishi Sunak, because you appointed so-and-so. Jesus didn't get it. He's a poor judge of character. It can't be that, because as we read on, we find out that Jesus knows, anticipates, even plans everything that will happen. And Jesus' betrayal is going to be part of the plan that leads to his crucifixion, which is part of the plan that leads him to preaching repentance and forgiveness of sins to all nations. It's not that Jesus didn't realize, but it does mean that you can have a bad apple even in the middle of the fruit bowl. You can be right there in the middle of the structure, you think, but it turns out that you're a fake. And I guess at the end of it, it's meant to just unsettle us a little bit. And we're meant to ask, am I built on this foundation? Jesus as the cornerstone, the apostles and prophets, these 12, this book, this kind of Christianity, not one that I make up myself or choose myself, but this kind of Christianity. Am I part of that? Or is it just that everyone else thinks I'm part of that? And it turns out I'm a fake. In these days, Jesus went out to the mountain to pray, and all that night he continued in prayer to God, big moment in his life. When day came, he called his disciples and chose them, 12, whom he named his apostles. Simon, whom he named Peter, Andrew, his brother, James and John and Philip and Bartholomew and Matthew and Thomas and James, the son of Alphaeus, Simon, who was called the Zealot, Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, he became a traitor. And so Luke writes this, and he wants us to be sure, certain, so certain that we're going to go and tell other people who aren't at Grace Church Greenwich today because they think all this is fairy stories, because they don't realize it really happened. And this is really the foundation. To give us confidence, but maybe also just to unsettle us a little bit. I'm going to pause and then we'll have our prayers in a moment.